Welcome, Capital Raisers. Dan Lukowitz came on the show to talk about brokerage, raising capital, and triple net lease buildings, which are the most passive form of commercial real estate by definition. Are you guys ready to raise? Shout out to InvestNext, our portal of choice, and our great friends at the Family Office Club. Do not miss the Strategic Capital Raise Conference on June 7th and 8th, 2024. Richard Wilson, Keeley Hubbard, and a bunch of your other favorite capital raisers are going to be there to blow the roof off the house. Register at strategiccapitalraise.com. With that, it's Capital Raiser Show episode 303, and it starts now. Rock and roll. I got Dan Lukowitz on the Capital Raiser Show. Welcome, my friend. How the heck are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man, we're going to have fun. I got a lot of energy today. The Capital Raiser Show season 4, powered by the Family Office Club and our new sponsors, InvestNext. Really looking forward to diving in to a lot of things. Dan, for the people that don't know you, tell us a little bit about your background, how you got involved in commercial real estate, and even maybe you can provide a little info on some of the capital raises that you've done in the past.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Dan Lukowitz. I'm a senior director here at Encore Real Estate Investment Services. So what that means is that I broker net lease investment sales transactions all over the country. A lot of single tenant net lease deals, as well as shopping centers and maybe some other assets that are slightly outside of those boxes. In terms of how I got here, I really got my start in real estate back in 2005. So we're pushing almost 20 years. I helped start a company with some friends called Disability Made Easy, which is a barrier-free home modification company. I was involved in the sales and marketing at that company, but I often spent time with our project manager. And I think for me, one of the aha real estate moments was just driving out with him to a property that when we got there, I said, I don't know what we're doing here. This individual is in a wheelchair and the property is not handicap accessible. This is like, we might as well just tear the house down. And I just watched over the next 90 seconds or so as our project manager sketch out a new front elevation and a new layout to the property. And that kind of emblazoned in my mind the idea of being able to take something that's maybe functionally a little bit outdated or even maybe obsolete, make changes to it, add value, and at the end of the day, have something that's worth even more than what you put into it. So that really kind of got me on a journey of house flipping, purchasing homes, renovating them, reselling them. Something I did over and over again. Probably at this point, I've flipped 75 or 80 houses over the years. At times, I was doing that as a kind of a side hustle in addition to a regular corporate job, whether it was at Amazon as a business development executive or elsewhere. And eventually, I went into that full time for a while and then transitioned into commercial real estate brokerage, which is where I'm at today, which is where I'll stay. I still do flip houses from time to time just because I like it and I kind of have that itch that I need to scratch. In response to the last part of your question, in terms of capital raising, I did have an opportunity to raise a lot of capital for the houses that I would flip. I still have that situation. Oftentimes I don't like to tie up too much liquid cash, especially if I'm doing multiple houses at once and I'm able to partner with investors or raise capital so that I can fund the projects. In addition, I do commercial real estate investments as well. In those investments, it's very similar, just on a much larger scale, in terms of raising capital from investors in order to get the deals done.
Cool. Very serendipitous. I'm about to go on to Angel Williams REI Rocks conference or virtual conference. We're going to be talking about residential real estate. A lot of people don't know that I got my start in raising capital for multifamilies, and it was from joint venture capital. The stuff that you did in the past, was it JV capital? Was it passive? Did you do a fund? Did you just raise from family and friends for individual SFRs? Tell me about that process real quick before we dive into the triple net lease business model.
Yeah, so it was a variety. It was kind of an all of the above to a certain extent, and it really was deal dependent. So for some deals, I would partner with a friend, for example, who wasn't a real estate investor, but obviously trusted me, believed in me, and wanted me to put his capital to work. And I would, in certain models that I had, he would supply the funds. I would handle everything else in the deal. He would stop by the property once just to take a look at it. And then he would receive a certain percentage of the profits. In other cases, I would say a far greater number of cases, I was essentially just borrowing money from investors at fixed rates, no points, no prepayment penalties. And I essentially had like a revolving line with those investors to be able to use those funds. And then if it took me a month, if it took me 2 months, I was still borrowing at the same annual percentage rate.
So you were raising, or I should say you were kind of doing private investor financing with personal guarantees, not necessarily backed by the real estate that you were doing? Just let it
Backed by
this.
Both. Good question. So backed by both. So that individual would have a lien on the property, but I also signed a personal guarantee. So in the event that something would happen with the property, that investor had not only the property to go after, which they easily could have, but also I personally was guaranteeing these loans as well.
Fascinating. Okay. And then, so they were lien holder, or I should say they were on the title of the property in some capacity. But in addition to that, the way that they got paid was a annual rate of return. It wasn't based on equity or percentage of cash flow or percentage of sales price.
Exactly. So I'm thinking of one individual in particular that I have a very strong relationship with, and I did most of my investing with this individual. I would hold title in my LLC, but he would file a mortgage and a promissory note, and he would have a beyond the insurance and the title policy and all that stuff, would have nothing to do with any cash flow the property generated. These were almost all exclusively flips, so there was no cash flow. But I was paying a set monthly annual return that every month I had an interest-only payment that I would pay to him. And then obviously, like I said, he had the security of the property as well as that personal guarantee that I had signed. And then at closing, I would pay him off. I'd get a discharge and that would be that, and then move on to the next. And he just wanted me to keep putting that money to work because he was and is using his and his wife's IRA to continuously lend out capital and just grow his nest egg.
So how easy or hard was it to partner with people this way? Did you have any mental blocks that you had to overcome in order to go and manage people's capital in your projects? Or was it pretty straightforward and you just kind of did what you normally do as a entrepreneur?
It was definitely very straightforward. I will tell you, it's definitely a responsibility and a burden. Anyone who's flipped even one house knows that if there's one thing that's for sure, it's that nothing's for sure in house flipping. Things yes. always go wrong. If they can go wrong, they do go wrong. They will go wrong. That's guaranteed. So for me, it gave me a lot of heartburn when projects went longer. And I knew I was paying relative to what I could go out to a bank and get financing at. I was paying a higher interest rate. So that did give me heartburn. But thankfully, we're talking about deals that had a big enough spread in them that it didn't matter. So I always tried to just consciously recognize that, hey, this is an interest expense. It's a necessary expense. It's allowing me to scale. It's allowing me to do deals I wouldn't otherwise be able to do. And yes, it is cutting into my profit margin, but it's just cutting into my profit margin. So for me, I was able to psychologically kind of separate it and just look at it as an expense to do the deal. And he would always tell me, say, Dan, if your deal doesn't work, if you can't afford to pay me, then you don't have a deal. And, you know, every deal we did together was the reason we did it was because it was a deal where I could afford to pay him.
Very cool. So you and I have a good friend that we share in common. His name is Benjamin Kogut. If you're looking on LinkedIn, are you still by chance in a mastermind with this guy?
So Ben is like one of my best friends. I just talked to him today. We have an accountability. Oh man, you couldn't have said, I was wondering where you were going to go, who you were going to say. And you couldn't have picked a better individual. Ben and I are in the Next Level Mastermind together. It used to be much more active. We've kind of, for whatever reason, it's not as active as it used to be. But one of the things I got out of the Next Level Mastermind, I got a lot of things out of it. But one of them was we had accountability partners that we were supposed to have for one quarter and then switch. And Ben and I were accountability partners. It came time after the quarter to switch. And we're just like, no, this is too awesome. So we have a 1-hour phone call every single week. And we're probably going on like 4 years at this point. Mm-hmm. And I love Ben to death. He's an incredible individual in terms of raising and like someone I look up to. Ben Kogut is definitely it. So I'm so happy that you mentioned his name.
Yeah. And you guys share some of the same business endeavors or interests, which is he likes to purchase triple net lease buildings, raise capital for those things. Do you partner with him in any capacity, or how can you describe the similarities in the business models that you each have?
Ben has bought properties from us when he was with other companies. There's definitely a huge crossover. Ben and I are partnering on a deal right now as we speak. I can't speak enough great things about him. If you don't know Ben, you got to reach out to him. Tell him that we said that you have to, but he's a great guy. And I've learned so much in my relationship with him, and I trust him with my life. He's a brother, and I'm so happy that we're doing deals together.
Okay, cool. All right. So let's dive into your primary business model, you're a broker and you like to educate people on triple net leases, something that we don't really talk too much about. We've been diving into more commercial real estate asset classes. That particular one is not talked about quite enough on the show. So I'd like to dive a little deep into this whole philosophy of why triple net lease buildings. I think I have some of the answers already, but let's go ahead and share those with the audience. What do you like about the asset class? And then we'll dive deeper.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, you know, my business model is as a commercial real estate broker. So I help investors transact on the purchase and sale of net leased assets. What I like about net lease is that there's a lot of factors that are very, very attractive. So you've got the stability and security of the asset, right? When you look at a net leased asset, every net leased asset comes with a lease, and that lease tells you in no uncertain terms pretty much everything about the property and everything about the relationship between you as the owner and the tenant. And everything is spelled out all the way down to what the rent is going to look like each of the next 20 years if there's rental escalations, for example. So I like the predictability. I like the stability and security as well. As I said, those properties are not just single unit operators. It's not just, for example, one Taco Bell property where if that manager has a hard time or if that operation doesn't do well and they go dark and leave the property, they're not going to leave you high and dry because, for example, that lease might be guaranteed by Border Foods that has 200 plus locations. So you have that inherent stability and security. You have the predictability because of the lease. Because of those built-in rental escalations, you have that hedge against inflation. And you also have the underlying fundamentals of the real estate. So keeping in mind, a lot of these deals are tenanted by national tenants who had a very specific and strict selection process that led them to believe that that location was a fitting location for their operation. In many cases, that location is nearby or in close proximity to many other national retailers. In many cases, they're on hard corners with stoplights, with huge traffic counts, great population density, great demographics. So I like the fact that the underlying inherent real estate has value. That's another factor that's really important. And then another thing is scalability. For example, if I'm buying houses, it's going to take me a long time to be able to scale to have a portfolio of 10 or 20 or $30 million of houses. But to scale, to get to 10, 20 or $30 million of net lease, it's not that difficult. So I think that's another advantage as well that's sometimes overlooked.
So I'm curious about this because I don't think that a lot of real estate agents or brokers, a very small percentage of them are in commercial real estate, and even smaller percentage are in this specific niche class. So how did you scale into this? Did you start by just associating yourself to the correct broker and then learn along the way? Or, I mean, because this is a challenging process, not only to do sales, but to get into high value property acquisition and sales. So how did you manage to become a broker in such a well-regarded niche?
I was at the time working for Amazon, and I know my dad was always pushing me to find someone within the Amazon real estate department to talk to them about real estate opportunities. Because if you look at it, you look at like what Amazon does, they take some dirt and they build, or they have a developer build a building on that dirt, and then they sign a lease. And that lease is guaranteed by a blue ribbon AAA company. So essentially that they're like, if you were to take that building and put it in the same exact location without the Amazon lease, it's worth a fraction of what it is with that tenant in there. Mm-hmm. So my dad, even though I wasn't able to do that because Amazon was pretty siloed in terms of how the company worked, it really got my wheels spinning. And I started thinking, well, wait a minute, what about, how does it work with Walgreens and Taco Bell and Rite Aid and Dollar General and all these other companies? At the same time, I had a brokerage locally that reached out to me, and they had a position available at the brokerage. I did some research. I started to learn a little bit about them and about what they did. And at the time, I was still flipping houses, and I knew it was time to leave Amazon. And I couldn't make a decision, like, do I go 100% full-time into house flipping or do I go into commercial brokerage? And I didn't at that point, it was a mistake looking back, but at that point in my life, I wanted to continue the momentum of something I knew was making me money and giving me success, as opposed to starting fresh in brokerage, knowing that it could take me 6 months or a year before I get my first paycheck. So I went 100% full-time into house flipping. And eventually I kind of came to my senses. And what really I recognized was that house flipping is very active. It's very risky. I'm using my own capital. There's a lot that could go wrong. I look at my average commission for a net lease deal. My best flips pale in comparison. So at that point, I kind of made that transition into net lease brokerage, and I just tried to learn everything that I could, asking everyone questions, diving right in. I was fortunate that within 3 or 4 months, I was closing my first deals, and I really was able to get my feet off the ground and run real quick. And then it was just a matter of once you do 20, 30, 40 transactions, you really learn on the fly. And unfortunately, in our industry, there isn't really a lot of training, or definitely no formal training, which is why I did partner with somebody else from the Next Level Mastermind, Zach Raisinger, and created a course called the CRE Pro Course, which is a training course teaching people how to become commercial real estate brokers, because I recognized that I really had to break my teeth and figure it out on my own as I got started in the industry.
Now, you mentioned a very sexy aspect about the triple net leases, which is the stability from the corporate sponsors of these owner operators or people that tenant occupy the triple net lease buildings. Let me ask you this, because I'm curious, how has COVID and some of the economic climate changes affected the tenants, or have the majority of the people that you've put into your buildings that you've sold been relatively stable throughout all of these economic calamities, let's say?
Great question. So when COVID hit, it really put a monkey wrench into the commercial real estate system. For probably about 4 months, we saw transactional volume dip very quickly for about 4 months and then just take off. And in 2020, 2021, and 22, I mean, we had banner years, setting records, doing more transactions than we've ever done. It was an interesting time. So what happened was a few things. Number one, there became this focus on what we call, you know, like essential retail. That wasn't really a buzzword before the pandemic, but essential retail, which when you speak candidly, if you're an investor and you're looking to invest in retail, you should be investing in essential retail, pandemic or not. You want things that people, necessary retail, essential retail. So that became a bigger focus. Anything with a drive-through still to this day fetches a premium. I think that COVID forever changed the formats and the layouts of quick service restaurant. You look, since COVID hit, every single major national concept for quick service restaurant, whether it's Taco Bell or Burger King or McDonald's, has shifted to a smaller and smaller format. Many of them are announcing now. Taco Bell just announced they're working on a prototype right now in Texas. They've already built one, and it has no interior dining space. So we're moving more people to the drive-through. More to these Grubhub and Uber Eats and DoorDash type services. We're seeing changes in different asset classes like quick service restaurant that probably wouldn't have occurred were it not to be for COVID. In terms of the calamities, as you kind of just referred to them, I think that I can give you a perfect example. Okay. I sold a Wendy's property. When was it? Beginning of COVID. I sold the property. Everything was great. Sales were good. I have it listed now again to sell a second time for the current owner. Because during COVID, this franchisee, even though they're a very solid franchisee, they operate 57 Wendy's properties across the state of Michigan. The problem is that they were having challenges with labor. There were some significant labor shortages, which can be attributed to a lot of different things. So what that did was that forced the store to close during certain hours, right? Limit their hours. And then that limited their sales. And that really made the owner concerned. Well, now I've got a property. It's not performing like it used to perform. I'm concerned. It's a problem property. So that's a problem that wouldn't have happened were it not for COVID. And I think that we're seeing it even more globally as, for example, this year alone, Tom's Kings, a large Burger King franchisee, 90-unit operator, they filed for bankruptcy. And then a month later, Meridian, which is a 127-unit franchisee, pretty big franchisee, also filed for bankruptcy. And they both cited the same things. Increase in labor, increase in food costs, difficulty staffing their stores, overexpansion, and then now problems servicing their debt. And we're seeing, unfortunately, a lot of larger franchisees imploding and filing for bankruptcy because of the strain of the pandemic.
Fascinating. What do you see for the future of triple net lease?
Triple net lease is a strong asset class because large real estate investment trusts, family offices, funds, et cetera, put a tremendous amount of capital into it. In addition to everything I said before about the benefits of net lease, you also have the fact that of any type of real estate investment, it is by definition the most passive, maybe with the exception of maybe note investing or private lending or something like that. But there's risks in that as well. But there's a certain level of passivity that a lot of people have, it's appealing to a lot of people. Triple net has become a massive wealth preservation tool. I see us as having a very strong industry that has a lot of price stability. And I think that that's very important today. We did not see a massive fallout in prices like we have in other asset classes in triple net. So I believe that that is, it speaks well to its strength, not only during the pandemic, but now during this whole rapidly increasing interest rate environment. So I see good things. I definitely see a lot of changes. I'm very curious to see what's going to happen and how it's going to shake out with all these pharmacies, with Rite Aid filing for bankruptcy recently, as well as some of the changes in the format sizes. Walgreens, typically 15,000 square foot stores, roughly. They have a Cooper concept now that's like 2,200 or 2,500 square feet. So I think we're going to see a lot of right sizing of properties, especially because of the increase in construction costs. So just a lot of undercurrents that are making it very fascinating to be in it, you know, to be part of this.
What about the future of Dan? What do you see yourself doing over the next 10 years? Are you going to be a broker in 10 years? Are you going to move into anything else? You're going to take your money that you're making from commissions on these triple net lease buildings and put them into some kind of asset class? Tell me about what you are thinking about doing over the next 10 years.
I'm definitely a broker for life. I love what I do. I love my clients. I love doing deals. My personality is so well suited for this. I love to hustle. I love to grind. I love to be stimulated, intellectually challenged. The highs of the deal really get me going. I am working on building a team, you know, expanding my team here at Encore and helping to train other people, helping to give other people what was given to me in terms of this life-changing career. I am very fascinated by what I kind of alluded to on our conversation earlier, which is the repurposing specifically of quick service restaurants. I'd like to get more involved in that in terms of purchasing, you know, old quick service restaurants and then repurposing them to other major national chains. So I think for me, it's going to be a combination of just grinding away and doing what I do best, building my team, growing my team, helping with that synergy, and then also kind of expanding my reach within the commercial real estate investment space.
Who is the typical buyer of a triple net lease, or what are some of the percentages of the people out in the entire industry, not necessarily the ones that you work with, but are there syndicators, or are they typically always backed by some larger corporation institution?
Well, they can be anywhere from what I would call like your mom and pop owning 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, restaurants or pharmacies or net leased assets. Some people have built their wealth in other ways and then have just over the years accumulated these properties and have built up nice sized portfolios. I work with fund managers who have entire funds and boards where they raise capital for investors. They invest in net lease and then they give a return. I work with individuals who are smaller syndications where it's 1, 2, 3, 4 partners and they're raising capital from their group of doctors or lawyers or engineers or whatever it is, and they invest in specific types of deals. I have real estate investment trusts. You know, I've sold properties to publicly traded real estate investment trusts. So really, the investor profile is quite varied. And I think one of the things that they all have in common is that they're looking for relatively passive income. Now, keep in mind, I also sell a lot of shopping centers, you know, multi-tenant retail spaces. Those are definitely more active than your vanilla absolute triple net deal that I've been describing. And again, same thing. They could be individuals who are investing and want to buy one shopping center. I just sold one last week to a guy out of Hawaii who just is investing his own money. I sold one a few months ago to a client of mine who runs a whole fund that he has, that all they do is raise capital, buy shopping centers, raise rents, deploy some capital expenditure, and then, you know, some CapEx dollars, and then provide a return to their investors. So those are really the types of people that it appeals to for a variety of reasons.
Now, in some cases, did I hear you say previously in other conversations that you help some of these purchasers of the properties to raise capital or facilitate or participate in that in any capacity?
What I do, I have clients that have funds and I'll help them by essentially making introductions. I know I have individuals that want to place capital. I get calls all the time for people saying, Dan, I can't afford a $2, $3 million property. I can't even afford the down payment, but I got 50 or 100 grand. What do I do? And I will quickly refer them over to one of my friends or clients who can help them to place their capital that way. In different deals, buyers do offer to brokers to be involved, obviously with disclosure to all sides. That's another option as well. Primarily, my role is as a broker, but like I said, because people do reach out and want to place capital, thankfully, I have a good network of what I consider very solid operators for them to talk to.
All right. One more question before we jump into the lightning round. I'm curious, are you still running a podcast?
I'm not currently. I did record 167 episodes of my show, Dan on Top. I'm in the process of kind of getting my hands on that content and doing a push to put it back out there. I'm not actively recording as a host podcast episodes. I'm definitely speaking on a lot of podcasts. But what I am doing is LinkedIn Lives. I have one coming up tomorrow with Chelsea Garber, who is actually, capital raiser, incredible individual. But yeah, I'm trying to stay in front of people and add value as much as I can. I quite frankly found that it was more advantageous to be on other people's shows. Okay. I was getting more deals from being a guest than I was from being a host.
I can see that. Depends on which shows you go on to, but I definitely heard something similar in the past. All right, so let's dive into the lightning round. My first question to you is, what is the best vacation you've ever taken?
Appropriately, I went last, I don't even know when it was. It was December, I think, of 21. I went to Isla Mujeres with my wife and Ben Koget.
Oh, yeah. I think I saw photos of that.
It was so amazing. We had so much fun. Great food, great weather, great people. And I was involved in a huge, nearly $50 million transaction at the time. And I just remember sitting there on the beach and being like, Ben, I'm sorry, man. I know we're on vacation, but we got to have a little accountability talk right now.
Hilarious. Favorite book of any kind?
There's a book called Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion by Robert Cialdini. Mm. Really great book on sales and persuasion. Absolutely incredible. Very, very valuable. I'm not a multifamily guy, but I'm fascinated by it. There's a book called Multifamily Millions by Dave Lindahl. Anyone who's a multifamily person, that's definitely a book to check out. And then, as cliche as it is, Think and Grow Rich has been a life-changing book for me that I've read probably 5 or 6 times at this point.
Awesome. How much of your success do you attribute to mindset?
100%. I mean, there's no question. That's the craziest thing is I used to think it was bogus and it was just hippie whatever, but mindset is everything. It is absolutely everything. I could give you example after example, but I can tell everybody who's listening, whatever you want in life, if you set your mind to it, I don't care what it is, you will get it. It's just a matter of having the courage to set your mind to it.
Fantastic. How long do you want to live?
I want to live forever. Honestly, I'm scared of dying. I don't want this show to stop.
Cool. Best way to raise capital from your perspective? Short answer on this.
I would say it's just merely to provide value. Don't make a deal into a deal if it's not a deal. Provide value to people. Bring them something that they want to invest in. Bring them something you would want to invest in, and you'll be successful. I think that's just the number one.
I love that. Can you tell me about a moment that changed the trajectory of your life?
Definitely. When I was leaving Amazon, I was a well-paid business development executive, and I saw my life continuing that way. And I just remember just stopping and thinking, like, how many houses do I have to own in order to replace my Amazon salary? And when I came up with that number, I went out and bought them immediately. And then I raised the capital. I used to be a little bit more of a kamikaze, but I bought them and then I raised the capital, or I got them under contract, I should say. And then I raised the capital from a friend to put things together. But that was an aha moment for me, was just to understand that, like, if I wanted to, I could replace my corporate W-2 income. And it's the same thing now as a broker. I don't have a W-2, I don't have a guarantee. There's no guarantees. But that aha idea of, like, I can make it happen, I can fend for myself, has really shaped the rest of my life.
Okay, I get a lot of varied answers to this next question, including, I don't want to 10X my business, I've already done so. But let me ask you anyways, what would you need in order to 10X your business?
First and foremost, it would be mindset. I think for me, I'm holding myself back because I don't want to, like, at several points in my life, expanded businesses too quickly and then had to scramble to put them back together. So I would have to have that mindset shift of, like, yes, this is where I'm going. It's where I want to go. I can handle it. I'm going to be successful. So I think that's number one. And then number two, I would need the people. I would just merely need the right junior brokers to hire, the right admins to hire, the right, whatever you call them, outside of the country, assistants to hire. And then I'd be able to do it, no doubt.
Biggest difference between who you are now and who you were in high school?
I think it's my ability to pause. It's like my ability to slow down. I've always, my whole life, had an abundance of energy, which I believe is a gift. But when I was younger, I had a hard time reining that in. And I didn't have that focus and that control that I have today. And I think that for me has been a game changer.
A few more questions. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
Well, I would extend spirituality to this like metaphysical mindset, connection, universe concept. So that being said, yes, absolutely.
Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
I would say absolutely. When I was in college, unfortunately, my best friend was killed in a car accident. I was supposed to be in the car with him, but there was just a tremendous number of factors that kind of lined up. And then when I got the phone call to come get in the car, something just told me, like, just wait a little bit, just don't get in the car. And I went back to my dorm. It was a Saturday night. I went back to my dorm for 15 minutes, and then I got another call that says, you got to come here because it was a terrible car accident. And I know that to me, it definitely felt like a miracle. It definitely shaped my life. I mean, I miss my friend tremendously. In December, it'll be 20 years since he passed away, but I feel incredibly fortunate that I did not get into that car that night.
A lot of people do not tap into their inner intuition or gut feeling that tells you to do or not do things. Highly recommend tapping into that. Last question of the day brought to you by Shanna Amigo, one of our great listeners. She would like to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
I love educating. I really love educating. So I would love to be able to educate a large number of people, whether it's through a course or a book or a training program or something, where I can change their lives and help them to become financially independent through either real estate brokerage and or real estate investing. I think that for me, that would help me to feel like I lived my life serving others and helping others, having a positive impact.
Beautiful answers on the lightning round, my favorite part of the show. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. Shout out to my sponsors, Family Office Club and Invest Next. Dan, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
Yeah, so first of all, you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm very active there. My first name is Dan, last name Lukowicz, Lewkowicz. Again, Lewkowicz. Additionally, if you want to reach out, if you want to talk about commercial real estate or real estate, if you have a property, you want to know what it's worth, you want to buy, sell, or list your property, you can call me directly on my cell phone at 248-943-2838. Again, 248-943-2838.
Okay. Any last parting words of wisdom for the aspiring triple net investor, syndicator, or capital raiser as they scale on their journey?
Yeah, I would just say, make sure that you exercise that muscle of underwriting and of learning and growing. If you're looking to do deals, like I tell people, when I went, my wife and I moved about 2 years ago to a neighborhood we always wanted to live in. And I remember when we started looking for houses, we went to the first house and we were just like, this is amazing. I love this house. Let's sign on the dotted line. And I said to my wife, I said, hold on, let's go look at 10 more houses and then make a decision. And we went and looked at a second house. We said, oh, that house has an attached garage. I didn't think about that. Oh, that house has 10-foot ceilings. I didn't think about that. It's the same thing with deals. If you want to become an expert in underwriting deals and in purchasing deals, do as many as you can and link up with great people who are willing to help you. There's so many people that are willing to help. This is an abundance mentality field. So, you know, don't be shy. Reach out to people like myself, like Ruben, and make sure that you're practicing and exercising that muscle of underwriting and learning and growing as much as you can. And I would say, like, something that's also very important is find mentors out there, find teachers out there, and don't try to show people what you know, especially in the beginning. Find other people and learn from what they know, learn from their mistake, learn from their successes so that you can also be successful yourself.
Awesome stuff, my friend. Typically, I don't know the direction or have any preset questions other than the lightning round. We had an amazing conversation today, dude. This has been a really cool conversation, dude. I appreciate you coming on the show, man. And I look forward to following your progress, man. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.